You're listening to another top-rated radio show on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to the American Hour with your host, Commander Tom Garcia, on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Good evening, everybody. This is Commander Tom Garcia. You're listening to the American Hour, and of course, I am assisted by my lovely co-host, Paula Lozon. How are you tonight, Paula?
Oh, I'm doing awesome. It's 49 and overcast up here in the greater Boston area. Feels like fall.
Yeah, it's getting balmy. Okay. All right, well, it's been worse. At least it's not snowing. That's the good news.
Oh, not yet.
Well, have you been following what's been going on with the Supreme Court hearings on Obamacare?
A little bit. I've been busy with the energy consulting thing, unfortunately. Unfortunately, but I mean...
Yeah, I've been you know, checking out as much as I can stand. And, you know, for however many hours they listen to this stuff each day, you wouldn't want to read the entire transcript. But I've been through some of the transcripts and picked stuff out and highlights. And, of course, I don't know who's got copies of all of the audio, but you can find highlights on the Internet. And so I spent the day scrounging around trying to find some good highlights, so I didn't have to just read everything to folks.
Right.
But there's some very interesting stuff. But before we get into that, I'd like to give a shout-out to our good scumbag racist friend, Spike Lee, who passed on via Twitter the address of the gentleman accused of killing this black kid here in Florida, up in Sanford. And
really?
As more information comes out, he said it was the Black Panther, said $10,000 reward for this guy's head, Zimmerman, I think his name is. And here's his address. And Spike Lee forwarded that on. Now, you can imagine Spike Lee has got a lot of followers on Twitter.
Yeah.
So he basically just passed on something that could have very well gotten somebody hurt. And guess what? Turns out the address is the wrong address. It's an elderly couple who lives there. They had to flee their house and leave town.
Oh.
They're not the ones that had anything to do with it. But Spike Lee passed that on. And, of course, because he passed it on, it went to probably, you know, tens of thousands of people. So I've always considered Spike Lee to be one. So he gets our Dumbass of the Day award, but I've always considered him to be a dumbass. I've always considered him to be a racist. And now we know he's a mobster, you know, and he cares very little about human life and is willing to just throw out addresses when there's a bunch of uproar and we don't know anything but you know, really went on. Of course, as we're finding out more and more about what went on, it sounds like that this gentleman may have provoked the kid a little bit, or at least they had some exchange of words, but as he was walking away, an eyewitness says that the kid ran up, hit him from behind, then jumped on him when he fell down. They're beating on his face. And it turns out the guy's got a gash on the back of his head. He's got a broken nose and bruised up face. And the police have said absolutely on the 911 call in the background, the screaming, stop it, stop it, was the guy who was the shooter. So, you know, if you have an exchange of words with somebody, and then they start attacking you and beating you, you are within your legal rights in the state of Florida to shoot them. That's what the law says. It's not that they just walk up to you and start threatening you when you shoot them. This guy was on the ground getting beaten up and saying, stop, stop, and the kid wouldn't stop. Now, that's what we know from one eyewitness. That was what Zimmerman's story was. So I don't know what the truth is. The police are going to investigate it.
Right.
But the truth will come out. But all these leeches, like Jesse Jackson and what's his name, the other piece of crap that looks like Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton. Yeah, I saw him the other day. He's got his index finger up in the air as he's talking. He can't talk without his index finger being up in the air.
Oh.
What a dork. Yeah. So anyway, they jumped right on the bandwagon because they want to turn it into a racist issue. See, these guys live and breathe by racism. That's how they make their money. Via racism. So they've got to keep it alive. Anyway, so just a shout out to our dumbass of the day, Spike Lee. and I will never, ever watch any of his movies. I never have. So there we have it. Now, today we have got a lot to talk about. We are going to talk about, and we got lots of quality audio bites and discussion that you're not going to hear in the mainstream media about the Supreme Court hearings. There's a lot that's been going on, hours and hours, and some of it, you know, if you've ever sat in a courtroom, can be extremely boring. But the highlights start to paint a picture of where the Supreme Court may go. Now, if you aren't familiar with the process, today it's done. It's over. They, and, you know, over the 3 days, they looked at different things. One on the first day was, you know, should we even be hearing this now? Because taxes that are going to kick in or penalty, because it doesn't even say anywhere in the bill tax, it says penalty, don't kick in for another couple of years. And there is federal law that says you can't sue somebody for taxing you if you haven't even been taxed yet. But the justices got around that and said, yeah, we're going to hear this anyway. And we don't, the details don't matter. That's not the big constitutional issue. Yesterday, what they heard was, is the individual mandate constitutional? That was the big day. Now, today, what they heard, testimony was, okay, if it turns out to be unconstitutional, does that mean the whole bill has to be thrown out? And I'm going to explain to you at the end of this precisely why, if it's unconstitutional, they will throw the whole bill out. I guarantee it. And then the final thing was the states were told, you're going to increase Medicaid payments and increase your burden of Medicaid, or some of the federal help that you typically get is going away. When we say federal help, we mean cha-ching dollars. The dollars that have been taken from us, Paula, you and me, to begin with, as we reside in our home state, the federal government takes money from us, then decides how to give it back to the states. You know what? Why not just take less from us and let the states take a little bit more so that it just stays within the states? But see, that's called money laundering, because then the federal government has to skim off that to pay their costs for taking our money, for taking all of our money. Anyway, so that's what went on through today. Now, here's how the rest of the process works. Within the next couple days, if not already this afternoon, they would have taken a preliminary vote. Show of hands, who says, you know, unconstitutional, who says constitutional, and they'll divide the court up, and they'll start working on briefs and opinions. And those briefs and opinions will get circulated amongst themselves, and it may sway somebody that was on the other side to come on over and join them because it's compelling. It may do that, and it has in the past. That remains to be seen. They have until this session adjourns in June, which they have said they will have a ruling by June. And I can't remember what the date is, if it was the 10th of June or the 28th of June or some such thing. But in June, so a few months away, well before the November elections, and both well before the primaries for many, many states, there will be a rendering on this. Now, the left has already been scrambling because it has not looked good on their behalf for the line of questioning that's been going on. And we're going to hear some of that line of questioning. It's going to make it very clear precisely why they are wetting themselves right now. And they're preparing, getting ready to say, oh, well, you know, this only makes Obama's hand stronger because, you know, people are going to be ticked off. And no, the majority of Americans don't want Obamacare, so they're not going to be ticked off. But, you know, they're going to spin it. And then the other thing is they're going to spin the court. They're going to take anything that was ever said by these justices during these proceedings and try and show that they're either a racist or a nut job and on and on and on. They're going to spin it and go. And in the end, you know what they're going to say? It's not Obama's fault. No, not his fault. You know, he didn't want this health. I can hear this now, Paula. He didn't want this health care bill to begin with. What are you guys talking about? It's got nothing to do with him. Stop calling it Obamacare. Anyway, was there anything that you noticed in the last couple of days? I know you were busy. If not, no big deal. We'll start getting right into some of our audio clips and discussion about what's going on. But was there anything that you saw? Well, it could be either this discussion or anything in the news the last couple of days or over the weekend since we did our last show.
Gosh, no. Just a couple of environmental things that I had sent you, a couple of energy.
Right.
Energy news articles that I had sent you, but that's about it.
Okay. Well, that's important stuff, but it's all getting kind of sidelined right now because of what's been going on in the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
We're going to have, hopefully next week, Mark Vance, who is a constitutional expert, on the show to talk to us about some of these proceedings, because as more and more discussion comes out about the briefing, it's a lot to go through right now, then there's going to be more discussion. And so we're going to have him on the show. I've already talked to him last week. We just need to schedule which day we're going to have him on. On the 11th of April, we are going to have the Occupation Party representative. I think it may even be their president. It's on Facebook, our Facebook page. And, hey, if you haven't been to our Facebook page, you got to go. And tell your friends to go. And click on that like button. And we've been gathering a little head of steam. By the way, with Twitter, we're doing fantastic. We are three, as I looked an hour ago, we're three people shy, Paula, of Twitter followers on Twitter on the American Hour of 4,800.
There you go.
3,797. So three more people, and we'll hit 4,800. And I predict within another week, we'll be at the 5,000 mark.
That's awesome.
So, yeah. I wish we were at that mark with Facebook. Quite honestly, I think it's more important to have more people on Facebook. So if you're listening to the show, please go to the Facebook page and tell all your friends. Go see our page and click on the like button. Anyway, let's start off with an audio clip that is important. It sort of sets the stage for what's really going on here. It sets the stage to show how incompetent and how deceptive liberalism is, and that it just never works. So this is President Obama, back when he was candidate Obama, on the Ellen Show, the Ellen DeGeneres Show, talking about Hillary's plan for health care and why he disagreed with her.
She'd have the government force every individual to buy insurance, and I don't have such a mandate because I don't think the problem is that the people don't want health insurance, it's that they can't afford it. Well, if things were that easy, I could mandate everybody buy a house and and that would solve, the problem of homelessness. It doesn't.
Well, there you have it. The president said it himself. A mandate doesn't work, and he doesn't want one. Oops, but what happened, Paula? Well, let me tell you what he did during his campaign. He actually, because he felt so strongly about this issue, had an attack he had put together that went after Hillary for her support of the individual mandate. And in part, it said Hillary Clinton's attacking, but what she's not telling you about her health care plan, it forces everyone to buy insurance even if you can't afford it, and then you have to pay a penalty if you don't. Well, where are we today with Obamacare? Exactly that. Now, here's what happened once he was in office. In CBS interview in July 2009, he said, during the campaign, I was opposed to this idea because my general attitude, his general attitude, not reasoning or, thorough review of the subject or anything like that, just his attitude. That's how he bases his leadership and his decision-making, just an attitude, not the facts. The facts don't know. Why let the facts get in the way? It's all attitude. So my general attitude was the reason people don't have health insurance. In fact, that's one of the worst sentences I've ever seen, Paula. I campaigned for 2 years, and I can tell you, you can't go around saying my reason for supporting or not supporting something was my attitude. Not my research, not the experts I sat down and talked with, just my attitude. I was opposed to the idea because my general attitude, oh, not even specific attitude, but general attitude, was the reason people don't have health insurance is not because they don't want it, it's because they can't afford it. And if you make it affordable, then they'll come. I'm now in favor of some sort of individual mandate as long as there's a hardship exemption. A hardship. What's a hardship exemption? I'll tell you, I've got a hardship, Paula. I can't afford it. I don't want to afford it. Or, it's going to take away from my, cigarettes and booze, so that's a hardship for me. And not that I smoke or cigarettes or anything like that. But anyway, so Mr. Flip-Flop, and he is not shy at all of admitting that he campaigned hard against it, ran attack ads on Hillary over it, and then as soon as he's in office, oh, I've seen the light. We need an individual mandate that forces everybody to buy insurance. Okay, so that sets the stage. So what really happened is the people that are opposing Obamacare in court, briefing before the Supremes, are using his original argument in part that it's unconstitutional, and it's not necessary, and it won't help the situation. Anyway, okay, let's start off with our first audio bite from Elena Kagan and Justice Breyer, and, of course, you've got the chief counsel, Mr. Verrilli. And they're talking about whether it's a penalty or tax. Now, they're not actually discussing that. But Kagan, you listen carefully, she keeps calling it a penalty. But the lawyer for the administration and representing the government keeps referring to it as a tax. He won't say the word penalty. But nowhere in the bill does it say a tax. It says it's a penalty. He calls it something that it's not. So here again we have libtards lying through their teeth, using words that are completely inappropriate, but basically an outright lie. And I think one of the other justices calls him on that. Maybe it was Breyer.
The nature of the representation you made, that the only consequence is the penalty. Suppose a person does not purchase insurance, a person who is obligated to do so under the statute, doesn't do it, pays the penalty instead, and that person finds herself in a position where she is asked the question, have you ever violated any federal law? Would that person have violated a federal law?
No. Our position is that that person should give the answer no.
And that's because?
That if they don't pay the tax, they violated a federal law.
But
the
as
tax.
Long as they've paid the penalty.
If they've paid the tax, then they're
the tax.
With the law.
Why do you keep saying tax?
If they pay the tax penalty, they're compliant with the law. Thank you, Justice Breyer.
The penalty.
Right.
So that was Chief Justice Breyer correcting him, saying there's no such thing as a tax penalty. It's a tax or it's a penalty. It's one or the other. But this dork keeps referring to it as a penalty. So that's the kind of sliminess that they're going to that they use throughout this. And the lawyer for the administration, the chief lawyer, got laughed at because he's a joke. He really is a joke. There were times in these discussions with the justices where he just was stumbling over himself. I couldn't get a sentence out. They replaced him today. He did so poorly yesterday. They had one of the lesser lawyers, one of the associate representatives, take his place today because he did such a crappy performance yesterday. So the fact is it's a penalty. Now, it's been brought up, Paula, that, well, Social Security is a tax and a form of insurance. In other words, it's old age insurance, and that's how FDR sold it. But the Supreme Court ruled that you can't force people to buy insurance. So they turned it into a tax, and that's why here is the major difference. I mean, you're not going to hear this in the news. You're not going to hear this in the mainstream media. The difference between Social Security or Medicare and Obamacare is if you have a job, it comes out of your pay. You're going to pay it. If you don't have a job, you don't pay it. But this penalty is in place because they need everybody paying into the system. They need money from everybody, or there is not enough money to support this government-run healthcare system. So that's why they penalize you. Now, I guess if you don't have a job and you don't have any money, then that's what Obama is saying. There's got to be a hardship exemption. But what if you're a retiree and you're not having money taken out of a payroll tax? You're still going to pay for insurance. You're going to have to pay for it. What if you retire? And when I say retired, I'm not talking 65. There are a lot of people that retire at 50, 55. They did well for themselves. They have enough money, and maybe they're not rich. They're not millionaires, but they have enough money. They don't have to work. So the big difference between Social Security or Medicare is that it comes out of your pay, and only people that are working pay it. But Obamacare, everybody's going to have to pay into it because they need everybody's money to support this massive, titanic program that is already exploding in cost. So that's the difference. That's the key difference. Let's take a listen to Justice Kennedy as he makes a very, very important statement that really got a lot of people's attention. Now, this has been in the news, but he makes other comments here that, you know, haven't necessarily made the news. We're going to play it all. It's about a minute and a half. And the way he finishes up, though, talking about this fundamentally changes the relationship between the federal government and individuals. And what he's getting at is you need to prove to us that this is necessary and constitutional. And they're not able to do it. I mean, this lawyer for the administration for the government did a poor, poor job. But here we go, Justice Kennedy talking about the individual mandate.
The key in Lochner is that we were talking about regulation of the states, right? And the states are not limited to enumerated powers. The federal government is.
I'm going to stop that for a second. When he talks about Lochner, it was a case quite some time ago, Lochner versus New York, where the state of New York passed a law saying that butchers, or no, it was bakers, could only work 10 hours a day, 60 hours a week. And it was because it was felt the kind of work that they were doing in the heat with the ovens and everything could be detrimental to their health if they worked more than 10 hours a day. Now, some of the employers said, no, our bakers can work 12 hours a day. We got a contract with them. So the Supreme Court came in and ruled that the state could not impose those kind of requirements on employees and employers. Now, without getting into all the details of why they said that, that violates a fundamental statute in the Constitution, that the states have police power, police state power, that the federal government doesn't. The federal government has specific enumerated and limited powers, but the states have everything else, which means the states can do things like that. Now, they tried arguing that the 14th Amendment with due process somehow allows that. But the bottom line is this. What you need to know, because you hear the justices talk about this, and you may have heard it in the news, in West Coast Hotel Company versus Parrish, about 40 years later, the Supreme Court ruled the opposite way in a similar case where the state was trying to regulate work hours, work rules, et cetera. The Supreme Court said, no, the states have the authority and right to do this if they can show that it's for the welfare and some of the other issues associated with that of the people in general, that they can pass these kinds of laws. So it really went back to the constitutional meaning of the states having all the other powers that are not enumerated to the Constitution. So when they say Lochner, what they're talking about, Lochner was really not a ruling about what the states could do. It was really – well, it was, but it was also a ruling that said, look, the federal government can't do this and the states can't do it. Now, see, there's the key. They're trying to bring up – these lousy administration government lawyers are trying to say, but in Lochner, you know, the states weren't allowed to oppose this or allowed to implement this. So if somebody's going to implement this, it's got to be the federal government. And Justice Kennedy is basically saying, yeah, not really. The real point is the focus was on the states. And that he doesn't say it in this, and that's why I'm explaining it. It was overturned later on. States do have that authority, but it was continued to be upheld. The federal government does not. Okay, so let's listen to this exchange again.
Key in Lochner is that we were talking about regulation of the states. Right, and the states are not limited to enumerated powers. The federal government is. And it seems to me it's an entirely different question when you ask yourself whether or not there are going to be limits on the federal power as opposed to limits on the states, which was the issue in Lochner.
I agree, except, Mr. Chief Justice, that what the court has said, as I read the court's cases, is that the way in which you ensure that the federal government stays in its sphere and the sphere reserved to the states is protected is by policing the boundary. Is the national government regulating economic activity with a substantial effect on interstate commerce?
But the reason this is concerning is because it requires the individual to do an affirmative act. In the law of torts, our tradition, our law has been that you don't have the duty to rescue someone if that person's in danger. The blind man's walking in front of a car and you do not have a duty to stop him, absent some relation between you. And there's some severe moral criticisms of that rule, but that's generally the rule. And here the government is saying that the federal government has a duty to tell the individual citizen that it must act, and that is different from what we have in previous cases.
Well,
that changes the relationship of the federal government to the individual in a very fundamental way.
And there you have it. It changes the relationship between the federal government and the individual in a very significant way. In other words, an unconstitutional way. This would be a major precedent-setting event, and if we listen to some of the other testimony, we're going to see what the other justices have to say about this change in this relationship between the government and the individual. But what Verrilli is trying to argue is that the government has the authority to regulate commerce that has a significant impact on interstate commerce. And this may have insurance, healthcare insurance may have a significant impact, but remember what the Constitution says. It says to regulate commerce among the several states. Well, Paul, if you and I aren't engaged in and don't have insurance and not engaged in commerce, then we're not engaged in commerce. It says the federal government can regulate commerce, not non-commerce. It doesn't say the federal government has the authority to create commerce, so then it can regulate it. And that's the big problem. See, if Obamacare had been written and said, we're going to take money out of everybody's paycheck, just like with Social Security and Medicare, and we're now going to call it health care, you know, on top of Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, they could have gotten away with that. But the problem is it wouldn't have been enough money. Remember, we now have 50% of Americans that don't pay income taxes. Now, they do pay payroll taxes, but what are they paying their payroll taxes with? Well, they're paying it with money that they're earning, but they, in some cases, they're getting a rebate. So ultimately, their payroll taxes, what's actually going to pay for Social Security and Medicare, is really being paid by other taxpayers because they're getting subsidies, they're getting food stamps, they're getting other things paid for by taxpayers. So what they're really actually paying payroll taxes with is money that came from somebody else, not money that they actually earned. So moving right along, how about when Justice Roberts asks lawyer Verrilli for the government if the government can now make him or anybody who doesn't have a cell phone buy a cell phone? Let me get that one right here. And it's kind of interesting. And there's some back and forth. And, of course, the Verrilli is constantly trying, oh, no, it's not the same thing. It's not the same thing. But these justices keep saying, but I think it is the same thing. And here's the real point you have to take away from all of these discussions, and that is, what is going to stop the government from now forcing us to do all kinds of other things in the future? And then is the spinoff from that, can they force us to not do things? In other words, Paula, I want to go on a vacation. You're going to go on a vacation. And the government says, nah, you're just going to go spend money in another country. You can either vacation here or not vacation at all and go to work. I mean, now they can control anything and everything that affects interstate commerce. They'll say that you going on a vacation in another country is spending money in another country and it's not helping our interstate commerce, so we're saying no to that. I mean, there's no end to this. And so that's really the answer. That's really the question. What limit government from using this to control everything in the future? And they don't have an answer for it. They can't answer it. Because their answer, you're going to see as we go through this, their answer is, well, there's got to be a legitimate market. Okay, vacationing is a legitimate market where you and I and everybody else may engage in buying a hotel or a resort and renting a car and on and on and on. If we go do that in another country to a significant degree, then what happens with the resorts and rental car agencies and Disney World and everybody else? Well, they have to start charging higher prices. That's exactly their argument for health care. If we don't get everybody involved, then the insurance companies have to charge higher prices. That's their argument. Okay, so let's listen to Justice Roberts ask about the cell phone question. About a minute and a half here also on the audio.
To that, the same, it seems to me, would be true, say, for the market in emergency services, police, fire, ambulance, roadside assistance, whatever. You don't know when you're going to need it. You're not sure that you will, but the same is true for health care. You don't know if you're going to need a heart transplant or if you ever will. So there's a market there. In some extent, we all participate in it. So can the government require you to buy a cell phone because that would facilitate responding when you need emergency services? You can just dial 911 no matter where you are?
No, Mr. Chief Justice, I think that's different. I don't think we think of that as a market. This is a market. This is market regulation. And in addition, you have a situation in this market not only where people enter involuntarily as to when they enter and won't be able to control what they need, what they enter. But
it seems to me that's the same as in my hypothetical. You don't know when you're going to need police assistance. You can't predict the extent to emergency response that you'll need. But when you do, and the government provides it, I thought that was an important part of your argument, that when you need health care, the government will make sure you get it. Well, when you need police assistance or fire assistance or ambulance assistance, the government is going to make sure, to the best extent it can, that you get it.
I think the fundamental difference, Mr. Chief Justice, is that that's not an issue of market regulation. This is an issue of market regulation, and that's how Congress looked at this problem. There is a market. Insurance is provided through a market system.
Wow. So we're talking about markets versus markets versus government, and the federal government's going to get involved because we want to save insurance companies money or save consumers money, but we don't care about saving the same consumers who are also taxpayers tax money. And you know what? If my taxes go up, Paula, I'm not going to have as much money to buy stuff on the interstate commerce market. So if the fire departments and the police departments all can save money by making us have telephones so that we can use them when necessary and be in contact and they can track us and on and on and on, then my taxes and your taxes may just be lower, which means we have more disposable income, which affects interstate commerce. See, they can't make an argument for this that holds any water because interstate commerce is so complicated, so complicated that you just can't put one finger on it and say, okay, this is it. That's all it is. The insurance industry is just that, just the insurance industry. And the other interesting thing is what they're doing is saying we need to keep costs down, health care costs down. So we're going to regulate not that industry, but we're going to regulate a totally different industry, health insurance. They're two different industries, and you'll hear that later on here. All this audio came from different places on the Internet. I think several of them came from one, and I don't have that link on my computer right here. I'd give it to everybody. I can do that tomorrow night. I'll go track it down. But some of this audio came from other places. So, but tomorrow I'll give everybody a link to the one main page that had quite a bit of this audio if you want to go listen to it on your own later on and check this out. Anyway, so that's Justice Roberts. He makes some good points. I do have to say this. The lawyer for the government made a pretty good point. He's talking about a market where there's commerce versus telling you have to have a cell phone so that you can help out your state government, and reduce your taxes and all that kind of stuff. I mean, that is somewhat valid. The problem is they want to stretch the interstate commerce clause so much that you got to start looking at all interstate commerce and anything and everything that affects interstate commerce. And that goes back to what I said earlier, Paula. Where does this end? At what point do you go, oh, no, that may be interstate commerce, but we're not going to touch that because, no, well, that would be going too far. Once you open the door, there's never too far for the government, and that's the problem. There's never too far. So next we've got Sotomayor, and actually she asked some good questions that she didn't lead. Kagan led. She would talk to this asking questions of Verrilli, and she would lead him at times and basically make the case for him. It's very, very clear that she wants this to succeed. And, of course, she was actually a part of drafting or looking at the legalities of Obamacare, although they say, oh, no, she was distant from it. Oh, no, she didn't have anything to do with it. She did. But Sotomayor didn't, and she asked a question about being forced into commerce. And, you know, is that something that we can, you know, the federal government has the right to do? And I think she was trying to get him to correct his earlier statement by saying, is this what you meant when you said this? Get him to correct it, but he doesn't do a very good job of correcting it. And I've got some comments about this, but let's take a listen to this. This is about a minute and 26 seconds.
The Congress enacted reforms of the insurance market, the guaranteed issue and community rating reforms. It did so to deal with a very serious problem that results in 40 million people not being able to get insurance and therefore not access to the health care market. Everybody agrees in this case that those are within Congress's Article I powers. The minimum coverage provision is necessary
not true.
To carry
Everybody doesn't
those
that.
Provisions into execution, because without them, without those provisions, without minimum coverage, guaranteed issue and community rating will, as the experience in the state showed, make matters worse, not better. There will be fewer people
How does
covered.
That constitution?
It will cost more.
So on that ground, you're answering affirmatively to my colleagues that have asked you the question, can the government force you into commerce? And there's no limit to that.
No, and no, because that's the first part of our argument. The second part of our argument is that the means here that Congress has chosen, the minimum coverage provision, is a means that regulates economic activity, namely your transaction in the healthcare market, with substantial effects on interstate commerce. And it is the conjunction of those two that we think provides the particularly secure foundation for this statute under the commerce power.
This guy said absolutely nothing. He's a buffoon. He said absolutely nothing that made any sense. I'm going to attempt to make some sense of this, Paula. Here's what he really said. He said, we can't cover people that need health care insurance unless we take money from everyone. We make everyone participate. So we passed legislation that says we need everybody to participate. Now that we have said we need everybody to participate, we make everybody participate. Now that everybody has participated, we have commerce to regulate. Now that we have commerce to regulate, we're regulating it. And by the way, we're not really making everybody purchase it. That was the legislation said we need everybody to participate. He's completely skipping over the fact that they made everybody do it. And that's what she asked. Does this mean the federal government has the authority to make you buy something? He said, no, this is a two-parter. We need everybody to participate, and we will regulate that participation, and there you have it. That's how we come up with making everybody participate without making everybody participate. Does that make sense, Paula?
It does. Yes, it does.
That's stupid. That is the stupidest argument I've ever heard. That will not hold water whatsoever, and Sotomayor tried helping him out, and he just stepped right in a massive pile of elephant dung. I mean, we first explain that we need you to participate, and then we're going to regulate that participation, which means, we get to make you do it. Because we get to make you do it because we said we need you to. It's so convoluted. It's unbelievable. So that's what this dumbass just said. Anyway, it's mind-boggling. So next we're going to go on to Alito. And I know that this stuff can get, believe me, I understand this stuff can get boring, and that's why I tried to pick the highlights, so that people can listen to this and hear the meat, the real meat of the discussion going on. So we've covered not only Kagan and Sotomayor, but Kennedy and Alito, and then we're going to get to Scalia and some sort of funny stuff. But next up is Alito talking about burial services. Now, he makes a really, really good point, I think, about everybody's going to die and need to be buried. And yet this guy says, well, no, it's not the same thing. There's a market. He asked him, is there a market for burial services? And he agrees. Anyways, this is about 2.5 minutes, but it's good. He makes a really good point, and you can see Verrilli squirming and unable to come up with a legitimate answer.
Do you think there is a market for burial services?
For burial services?
Yes.
Yes, Justice Alito, I think there
is. All right, suppose that you and I walked around downtown Washington at lunch hour and we found a couple of healthy young people and we stopped them and we said, you know what you're doing? You are financing your burial services right now, because eventually you're going to die and somebody's going to have to pay for it. And if you don't have burial insurance or you haven't saved money for it, you're going to shift the cost to somebody else. Isn't that a very artificial way of talking about what somebody is doing?
You know,
and if that's true, why isn't it equally artificial to say that somebody who's doing absolutely nothing about health care is financing
health care services?
I think it's completely different. The reason is that the burial example is not, there's the difference is here you are regulating the method by which you are paying for something else, health care. And the insurance requirement, I think the key thing here is my friends on the other side acknowledge that it is within the authority of Congress under Article 1, under the Commerce Power.
Not true.
To impose guaranteed issue and community rating forms and to impose a minimum coverage provision. Their argument is just that it has to occur at the point of sale.
I don't see the difference. You can get burial insurance. You can get health insurance. Most people are going to need health care, almost everybody. Everybody is going to be buried or cremated at some point.
One big difference, Justice Alito, is you don't have the cost shifting to other market participants.
Sure you do, because if you have money, then the state is going to pay for it.
That's a difference, and it's a significant difference. That this, in this situation, one of the economic effects Congress is addressing is that the many billions of dollars of uncompensated costs are transferred directly to other market participants. It's transferred directly to other market participants because healthcare providers charge higher rates in order to cover the cost of uncompensated care, and insurance companies reflect those higher rates in higher premiums, which Congress found translates to $1,000 per family.
But isn't that really a small part of what the mandate is doing?
Okay, this guy just lied, like, repeatedly. Paula, if everybody in the country were mandated to have burial insurance, even at the age of 20, 30, 40, on up, burial insurance would be way less than it is today. With the few people that actually get it because they don't want to have to pay a huge – it's not cheap to get buried. It's not cheap. Now, what he is saying is if you die and you got no money and there's no next of kin and they're not going to bury you, the state will do it. So it's not a cost shifting to other people with burial insurance. But the fact that you and I, unless you do, Paul, I don't, have burial service, burial insurance, there is a cost shift. The people that actually have it right now are paying more than if all the rest of us participated in. So there's a direct cost shift. Now, what about the people that don't have it? And then when it comes time to get buried, the cost shift for me walking into a hospital in Florida does not go to other insurance payers. It goes to the state. They cover the tab, and taxes go up to cover Medicaid. So he's got it completely wrong. The cost shift is up front. If you have more people, this is their whole argument. If we have everybody in the insurance pool, then insurance rates are lower. But if you don't have everybody in it, then insurance rates are higher. That is exactly the way the burial service, the funeral service business works. Exactly the same. And then when something happens, who bears the burden of that? It's usually the taxpayer, both in health care and in burial services. So he completely distorted it. He's saying on one hand that health care insurance gets, if you don't have it, it translates into higher rates. But then he's saying burial services, then when you die. So he's saying he's using two false assumptions. One, the higher rates with health insurance come from you not having insurance. But then he says if you die and don't have insurance, then that cost is shifted to the state. Well, the same is true. If you don't have health insurance and you walk into a hospital, that cost is shifted to the state. The state pays for that with Medicaid. So anyway, that's where this guy really stumbled over it. And anybody worth their salt, lawyer, especially the Supreme Court judges, they see right through all this stuff. That's why Alito said, no, it's the same exact thing, and he argued that it wasn't. And he can argue it all he wants. But if Alito and the other judges believe it is the same thing, then it is the same thing, and they are right. All right. The next audio is of Scalia, Justice Antonio Scalia. Excuse me. And he talks about the federal government regulating insurance versus, as the necessary and proper clause. And this guy tries bringing up the necessary and proper clause, and Scalia gives him a schooling. He takes him to school, to the first grade, and gives him a lesson on the 10th Amendment. So let's take a listen to that. This one, I believe, is a bit longer, unfortunately, but It's about 5 minutes long, but there's a lot of banter here. And then I'll discuss, you know, what went on there and what was meant. If I think it's pretty obvious, though. He makes some really good points.
We give a certain amount of latitude. I'm not sure which way the argument goes.
Let me try to answer that question, Justice Kennedy, and get back to the question you asked me earlier. I do think one striking feature of the argument here that this is a novel exercise of power is that what Congress chose to do was to rely on market mechanisms and efficiency and a method that has more choice than would the traditional Medicare or Medicaid-type model. And so it seems a little ironic to suggest that that counts against it. But beyond that, in this...
Okay, I got to stop it there. I just got to stop there. What he's saying is the Medicare models, he just admitted that the Medicare and Social Security models are flawed and don't work so good. He just admitted that. So they decided to rely on the market. In other words, make everybody join the market. Instead of just relying on people who work and pay taxes, make everybody pay, period. No matter who, what, where they are. Make everybody pay. So he just admitted Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid are flawed. And so they didn't rely on that model. They went into the market, and they want to control the market. Government controlling the market, not just taxing us, Paula. And so it's not about their ability to tax us, which he argued earlier. Remember, he kept calling it a tax, a tax, a tax. It's not about taxing us. It's about forcing us into a market controlled by the government. That's the vehicle they decided to use, and that is unconstitutional. So here we go. I'm afraid I can't start from where we were.
I'm not sure which way the argument goes.
That's why I stopped it right away.
Try to answer that question, Justice Kennedy, and get back to the question you asked me earlier. I do think one striking feature of the argument here that this is a novel exercise of power is that what Congress chose to do was to rely on market mechanisms and efficiency and a method that has more choice than would the traditional Medicare or Medicaid type model. And so,
right, because they're no good and they're unsustainable.
Counts against it. But beyond that, in the sense that it's novel, this provision is novel in the same way, or unprecedented in the same way, that the Sherman Act was unprecedented when the court upheld it in the Northern Securities case, or the Packers and Stockyards Act was unprecedented when the court upheld it, or the National Labor Relations Act was unprecedented when the court upheld it, Jones and Lockman, or the dairy price supports in Wrightwood Dairy.
Oh, no, it's not.
Roy.
They all involved commerce. There was no doubt that what was being regulated was commerce. And here you're regulating somebody who isn't commerce. Now, I don't agree with you that the relevant market here is health care. You're not regulating health care. You're regulating insurance. It's the insurance market that you're addressing, and you're saying that some people who are not in it must be in it. And that's different from regulating in any manner commerce that already exists out there.
Well, to the extent that we're looking at the comprehensive scheme, Justice Scalia, it is regulating commerce that already exists out there. And the means in which that regulation is made effective here, the minimum coverage provision, is a regulation of the way in which people and participate, the method of their payment in the healthcare market. That is what it is. And I do think, getting back to the question you asked before, what matters here is whether Congress is choosing a tool that's reasonably adapted to the problem that Congress is confronting. And that may mean that the tool is different from a tool that Congress has chosen to use in the past. That's not something that counts against the provision in a commerce clause.
It's both necessary and proper. What you just said addresses what's necessary. Yes, has to be reasonably adapted. Necessary does not mean essential, just reasonably adapted. But in addition to being necessary, it has to be proper. And we've held in two cases that something that was reasonably adapted was not proper because it violated the sovereignty of the states, which was implicit in the constitutional structure. The argument here is that this also is maybe necessary, but it's not proper because it violates an equally evident principle in the Constitution, which is that the federal government is not supposed to be a government that has all powers. that it's supposed to be a government of limited powers, and that's what all this questioning has been about. What is left? If the government can do this, what else can it not do?
This does not violate the norm of proper, as this court articulated it in Prince or in New York.
Yes, it does.
It does not interfere with the states as sovereigns. This is a regulation that...
That wasn't my point. That is not the only constitutional principle that exists.
An equally
evident constitutional principle is the principle that the federal government is a government of enumerated powers, and that the vast majority of powers remain in the states and do not belong to the federal government.
10th Amendment.
Do you acknowledge that that's a principle?
Of course we do,
okay,
Your Honor.
And that's what we're talking about.
And the way in which this court in its cases has police the boundary that of what's in the national sphere and what's in the local sphere is to ask whether Congress is regulating economic activity with a substantial effect on interstate commerce. And here, I think it's really impossible in view of our history to say that Congress is invading the state sphere. This is a market in which 50% of the people in this country get their health care through their employer. There is a massive federal tax subsidy of $250 billion a year that makes that much more affordable. ERISA and HIPAA regulate that to ensure that the kinds of bans on pre-existing condition discrimination and pricing practices that occur in the individual market don't occur.
I don't understand your point.
Whatever
the states have chosen not to do, the federal government can do.
No, not at all.
I mean, the 10th Amendment says the powers not given to the federal government are reserved not just to the states, but to the states and the people.
But
the argument here is that the people were left to decide whether they want to buy insurance or not.
But, Your Honor, this is what the court has said, and I think it would be a very substantial departure from what the court has said, is that when Congress is regulating economic activity with a substantial effect on interstate commerce, that will be upheld. And that is what is going on here. And to embark on, I would submit with all due respect, to embark on the...
Wow, this guy can't make a case to save his life because there is no case to be made. He keeps talking, Paula, about the means. In other words, the government has the authority to regulate interstate commerce, and this bill came up with a means to do that. Well, what's the means, mister? Tell us what the means is. It's making everybody buy it. That's what he's not saying. He says there's a means. Well, the means with this individual mandate is making people engage in commerce, and the federal government has no authority to do that. So he can call it what he wants, but it is coercion by the federal government to engage in commerce that you choose not to engage in for the good of the welfare of the whole and on and on and on. But so what he's essentially saying is Congress passed a law making everybody buy insurance so that they can regulate it properly to ensure that everybody has insurance. But they don't have the power to do it. Just because they wrote a law doesn't mean, and that's what the whole question is it constitutional? He's not saying it's constitutional. He's just saying they did it. They wrote all the bill, and therefore they now get to regulate it all. But why is it constitutional? He can't answer why it's constitutional. And the Chief Justice here said, well, you're talking about the necessary and proper clause, the legalese that he used there to say that it meets certain, you know, requirements and provisions. It does meet that. So you can call it necessary. You can say that it's necessary in order to, lower costs. It's necessary to make sure that people have health care. But is it proper? And he can't answer that question. He just keeps talking about, well, this court has ruled in the past. Well, name one. Name one time it's ruled in the past that it can force individuals to engage in activity. And he can't name that. He just can't do it. All right, the other aspect of that was, I said, so what's the problem? He said, well, look, the federal government's already engaged in all kinds of regulation of insurance, of healthcare insurance, to ensure that people with pre-existing conditions or with conditions aren't said, you know, oh, that was pre-existing. No, I just got cancer in. No. Okay, so the government's already engaged in that, controlling that. So what's the problem? Why do we need to do any more than that? So he almost makes the case for, well, if the government's so successful at doing what you just said, then what's the big problem? And he did make the statement, Justice Alito, that, or I guess we're actually talking about Scalia on this one. He made the point that health care costs are a problem, so you're going to regulate a different industry. Insurance. Well, they're tied together. No, they're separate. They're two different industries. This guy is, but he definitely took him to school on the 10th Amendment there, because he's saying, oh, no, we're not violating the 10th Amendment. We're not violating states' rights. We're staying on the boundaries, on the boundaries. No, they're violating state rights, because what if there's a state like Florida where there's a company that offers health insurance and I go and buy that, and it doesn't meet the federal requirements? They're regulating state, intrastate commerce, not interstate commerce, intrastate commerce. They're regulating all commerce, not just interstate, but intrastate. And that's one of the problems there, one of the big problems. All right, here's some of the other highlights. Scalia also asked about the, and this was when Verrilli was really flailing. Could you define the market? You know, define the market. For example, everybody has to buy food sooner or later. So you define the market as food. Okay, we've got a food market. And everybody is in that market, so we get to control that market. That's what he's saying with health insurance. Since everybody's in it or going to have to be, need to be in it some way or another, because, Paula, you and I don't have to buy food today, and we don't have to buy food tomorrow. We might not have to buy food for a month or 2 months, but eventually we're going to have to buy food. So we're either in the market now or we're going to have to be in the market. Therefore, you can tell people they have to buy broccoli. That's what he's the analogy he's creating. So you're not just telling them they have to buy food. You're telling them what food to buy. By telling what kind of insurance and how much and how and what it's got to cover and on, because quite honestly, young people could buy catastrophic insurance and just say, "Look, just if something really bad happens, I'm covered." But we're going to require them to buy something beyond that because we need their money. They're not going to get sick, most likely, but we can take their money and spread the wealth around. Same thing with food. So he makes a very good point there. Kennedy said. At other juncture, he said, can you create commerce in order to regulate it? And so the federal government says everybody has to join an exercise club. Okay, we're going to create commerce then so we can regulate it. And that's, again, his point with the whole means. Well, Congress put a means in the bill, which means we're going to force everybody to do it, and that means there's commerce to regulate, and we can regulate it and control everything. So same thing. Well, we need to regulate people's exercise. And because they'll be healthier. And that means we're going to, in order to regulate people's exercise so that they're healthier, we're going to go to a whole different market, not health, but gyms, health clubs. And we're going to take over that. And we're going to tell everybody, you have to buy. It's the same exact thing. We want to regulate one market or control one market. So we're going to regulate another market that's, involved. Now, the other one I want to read is where Verrilli is talking to Kagan. And he said, well, that was a point I was trying to make, Justice Kagan, that you're young and healthy one day, but you don't stay that way. And the system works over time. And so I just don't think it's fair. Oh, you're well and healthy, but you won't stay that way. And the system works over time. See, I'm stumbling. I'm doing as bad as this guy. This is the way he was talking. And so I just don't think it's a fair characterization of it. And it does get back to, I think, a problem. I think he can't stop saying I think because he can only think about this stuff. He doesn't know for sure. I think is important to understand. Then Scalia jumps in. He says, I keep saying his name right, Scalia. Justice Scalia says, these people aren't stupid. Now, a day ago was reported, he said, we're not stupid. That was a typo. What he actually said was, these people aren't stupid. They're going to buy insurance later. They're young now, and they need money now, and they don't need insurance now. Verrilli says, but that's, and Scalia jumps in, when they think they have a substantial risk of incurring high medical bills, they'll buy insurance like the rest of us. And then Verrilli, he stumbles, and Scalia says, I don't know why you think that they're never going to buy it. And that's the whole point, that they're going to need it someday. Well, good. They're going to need it someday, and that's when they'll buy it. And there are going to always be a few that drop through the cracks that get sick when they're young, but most people don't get that sick when they're young. I've got a doctor that I go to, and I make a copay of $20. But if I didn't have insurance, you know what I'd have to pay him? $40. So once a year, when I have a cold or flu or anything else like that, if I didn't have insurance, I'd go see him, and I'd pay $40. It's not breaking the bank. There are plenty of doctors around like that. You know, if you're the average person, especially when you're young, and I'm not young. Okay, finally, there's I've seen on all of the liberal blogs and websites this about Scalia when he makes a statement, and I've got the audio for that. When he makes a statement about, you think we're going to read this bill? Because what happened today was, remember, they talked about if the individual mandate is deemed unconstitutional, does that destroy the rest of the bill? Does that throw the rest of the bill out, or can the rest of the bill stand? And what the point he's making is, you think we're going to do Congress's job for them and go through an entire bill and look at every single item and decide whether each and every item is constitutional or not? Are you kidding me? So here's his comment on that. Now, I'll tell you what all the liberal websites have been saying about this.
To answer a question that several justices have asked, we think that severability is a matter of statutory interpretation. It should be resolved by looking at the structure and the text of the act.
Okay, severability. People are saying, well, what's severability? Severability means if the individual mandate goes down, does that mean that the rest of the bill goes down? And they never put a severability clause in there. A lot of times Congress will put a severability clause in there to make sure that, hey, if somehow this doesn't work out, the rest of the bill is okay. The fact is, if you can't make all Americans buy health care, then the money is not there to do all the things that they're trying to do. This is a multi-trillion dollar a year boondoggle that they put together, and they need everybody's money. So that's what severability means. Now, what this lawyer is making the case for is, well, severability, even though it's not in there, there's a clause in there, still, it's normal practice to look at the bill and decide, you know, if other things can stand on their own.
To answer a question that several justices have asked, we think that severability is a matter of statutory interpretation. It should be resolved by looking at the structure and the text of the act, and the court may look at legislative history to figure out what the text and structure mean with respect to severability. We don't
either. What happened to the Eighth Amendment? You really want us to go through these 2,700 pages? and do you really expect a court to do that? Or do you expect us to give this function to our law clerks? Is this not totally unrealistic that we're going to go through this enormous bill, item by item, and decide each one?
And there you have it. They're not going to go through every single item. That's ridiculous. That's not their job. If Congress is going to write a bloated bill with all kinds of things, some of which have absolutely nothing to do with health care or the insurance industry, and expect the justices to go through that whole thing? Do you remember when Nancy Pelosi said, we need to pass this bill so we can find out what's in it? She didn't read it. And the vast majority, probably 99%, they had 48 hours, 99% of the representatives that voted on that bill and senators did not read it. But they expect the justices to read it and pick through it and decide and discuss each and every item? There's no way they're going to do it. They're going to throw the whole thing out. They can't. And did you hear what he said? You know, you have to look at each item in its contextual context and the history and on and on. It's like, what, you want a ruling in 100 years on this? You've got to be kidding me. So, of course, and that's the point he's making, we're not idiots and going to sit here and do your bidding, the administration's bidding, and do the work that Congress should have done and this administration should have done. We're going to throw the whole thing out. If we deem it unconstitutional, the whole thing's going. Because there's not anybody, I guarantee you, none of the liberal justices are going to say, well, let's go through each and every item in this 2,700-page bill and decide which is constitutional and which is not, or which can stand with the mandate being thrown out. That's not their job to say, well, yeah, this will still work, and there won't be enough money for this. And that's not their job, so they're not going to do it. This lawyer is deluded, and that's the point Scalia was making. You're deluded, buddy. It's never going to happen. All right. We'll talk some more about this stuff tomorrow, and if I can get some more good audio clips, we'll go through that, because I think it's important to hear the banter that went on. And it gives you a sense of what the justices are actually looking at. They're not comfortable with this. They don't feel, they feel it's opening Pandora's box and going to give the government on down the road too much power. Where does it end? What protections do the people have on government being an all-controlling government? There really aren't any, not if this passes. And so that's the key here. Paula, any questions or comments?
No questions, but a comment on this whole thing, I guess in layman's terms, is that I personally don't feel that the money is going to go into the program. I think it's going to go into other programs that need the money. I feel that the government is looking, continuing to look for ways to try to bring the deficit down, and it's a way for them to make money just like everything else we get taxed on, whether they want to use the politically correct term as a penalty or a tax, whatever the case may be. And the fact that they feel that they want to mandate, it looks like, pretty much everything that we do, I'm just curious as to why more people aren't opening up their eyes and opening up their mouths and saying, no, this isn't going to fly.
Yeah, I think they are. Oh, one of the things I didn't mention was all of the libtard websites were saying that Scalia is saying, we're not going to read this bill. No, Scalia is not saying they're not going to read the bill. And some of the justices have said in one of the clips, one of the justices said, I've read through the whole bill. They've read the bill. But they're not going to sit down and hash out every item and argue and debate and write opinions on every single item and its constitutionality. But they've all read the bill. But here's what the libtard media did. They jumped and said, oh, Scalia says I'm not going to read the bill. Hey, buddy, it's your job to read the bill. Oh, really? How many Democrats read the bill before they voted on it and voted yes for it? Not a single one, including Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House. So this is what the liberal media does. They're full of crap. They lie, and they won't take any ownership whatsoever. When it passed, they were dancing in the streets. Did any one libtard say, hey, my representative didn't even read the bill before she voted on it or he voted on it? But the instant Scalia says, we're not going to debate and come to a determination of every item's constitutionality in a 2,700 bloated Titanic Trojan horse-filled bill. He did not say he wasn't going to read it, and I'm sure he has read it because he knows enough about it, and what he's talking about is he discusses items in it. So there you go, distorting the truth. It's despicable. Anyway, well, Paula, we'll continue this discussion tomorrow night, but for now, let's do our tribute to the troops.
Continuing our series with honoring the fallen, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq have claimed the lives of more than 450 Americans, bringing the U.S. death toll to more than 6,300 since 2001. Five names I'll be reading this evening: Patrick Ryan Carroll, 25, Nathan Brock Kars, 32, David Rudolph Carter, 47, John Paul Castro, 25, and Joseph Brian Kemper, 21. Off the Military Times website, Army Chief Warrant Officer David R. Carter lost his life August 6, 2011, serving during Operation Enduring Freedom. He was 47 of Centennial, Colorado, and he was assigned to the 2nd Battalion, 135th Aviation Regiment, the General Support Aviation Battalion, the Colorado National Guard in Aurora, Colorado. He lost his life on August the 6th in Wardak Province, Afghanistan, of wounds suffered when the CH-47 Chinook helicopter in which he was riding was shot down. He was considered an American hero. Let me see. He was a full-time Army National Guardsman and an instructor pilot. He was one of two pilots aboard the helicopter that went down that day, and it was apparently shot down by insurgents. That crash is under investigation. Out of the dead included 17 Navy SEALs, five special Navy operations troops who support the SEALs, 3 Air Force airmen, a 5-member Army air crew that included Carter, 7 Afghan commandos, an Afghan interpreter, and a military dog. He is survived by his wife and 2 children, and they had set up a college fund for the 2 children at First Bank, located in Aurora, Colorado. To the individuals serving overseas, specifically the National Guard, your families love and miss you dearly. They want you home real soon. We keep you all in our prayers and in our hearts. To the National Guard Bravo 182nd Unit that came home to Massachusetts after a year in Afghanistan, 75 soldiers greeted by family and friends at a homecoming this past Monday. The 182nd Infantry came home as well to TF Green after serving in Afghanistan as well. They were there for a year-long deployment.
All right. Very good, Paula. Well, thank you for that. I appreciate that. Let me just throw out here along the lines, NVHS, National Veterans Homeless Support. I spoke with the President, George Taylor, today on the 7th of April. They're having their annual dinner where they pay tribute to patriots and folks who have contributed to veterans in the state of Florida, and there will be some state leadership there from both American Legion and the VFW, as well as many different politicians, and it's going to be held in Vieira. Although the NVH is based up in Titusville, they're, I believe, going to be at the Holiday Inn. I'll put a link on the website tomorrow and Facebook, and a link to the NVHS Facebook page, et cetera, so that anybody that might be in the area is interested in going. It's a great way to support the NVHS. They're going to have some silent auctions going on, and if you have anything that you'd like to donate to the silent auction, they are taking items as well, and it's a great way to contribute to veterans. All proceeds will go to veterans, and it's a great great thing that they do, and George is just doing a great job. I won't talk about that. He's involved politically in helping candidates, and I've got him connected with some different candidates that we always need at the state level, politicians that care about our veterans, because we have the second largest veteran population in the country. So it's an important endeavor that he's involved in. Anyway, we'll talk more about that tomorrow, and like I said, I'll get the information on the website tomorrow and on Facebook and on Twitter, some of that stuff out as well. Paula, thank you so much. Pleasure as always, and we'll be back here tonight, same time. We'll talk a little bit more about the Supreme Court and Obamacare. Bye, Paula.
You're listening to The American Hour with Commander Tom Garcia on the USA Talk Radio Network.